America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, peace, freedom, truth. Well, and people who behave themselves, I guess.
It's naughty boy.
Oh, no.
Bad boy.
Again.
A naughty boy.
Larry,
nasty.
Get
out. Bad, naughty boy.
Who let him in here? I guess it's kind of the running joke of the day, but there I am going to, first of all, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. And our toll-free number, toll-free across the United States, 866-303-2270. And it's TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, participate in the blog, hang out on our message boards. There's a convergence here. Today is the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. The Larry Craig mess. I mean, actually, what pulled it all together very nicely, and I thought it was just brilliantly done, Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show on AM 620 KPOJ here, the radio station that I'm broadcasting from, and I participate in the last hour of that program and then do the national show from these studios here. Carl came up with a poll question that's over at the 620kpoj.com website for today. And it perfectly summarizes it. It's just brilliant. He says, the Republican National Convention begins 1 year from today in St. Paul, Minnesota. Where would you like to see the keynote address held? And then the options are in the men's restrooms at the Minneapolis airport. See, I mean, isn't this ironic? This Larry Craig, this is Minneapolis, this is where they're on the ruins of the I-35 bridge, in the nearest federal prison, or outside the Green Zone in Baghdad. And the voters here in Portland are voting for the nearest federal prison and mostly the Green Zone in Baghdad, but I think the ruins of the I-35 bridge really is emblematic. I mean, these are the bookends. The collapse of the bridge in Minneapolis, the collapse in some ways I'd say of the tragic collapse, frankly, of Larry Craig, who oddly enough opened his press conference by saying,
thank you all very much for coming out today.
And then proceeded not to do so himself. Nonetheless, the collapse of that. And Katrina. And I think that, well, first of all, from the Center for American Progress, their summary, their Think Fast summary today. 2 years after Hurricane Katrina ravaged New Orleans, quote, none of the 115 critical priority projects identified by city officials for publicly funding rebuilding efforts has been completed. None, zero of the $34 billion earmarked for long-term rebuilding, less than half has made its way through federal checks and balances to reach municipal projects. Now, I want to draw a contrast, and I think it's a useful and important contrast. First of all, let's remember the testimony of heck of a job Brownie. Remember Michael Brown? A little later on, when he was speaking out, he's kind of vanished now. He probably got the call from Guido. But anyhow, he said, "Well, I was feeling a lot of anger because I recall telling Secretary Chertoff back in 2004 and again in 2005 that this country was not ready for a catastrophic event. I had been to the tsunami in Southeast Asia. I came back and I told the president and I told Chertoff." We're not ready. We don't have the plans. We don't have the processes in place for something like this. And I think 2 years later, when we look at these photographs, it's proof that we're not ready for this kind of thing. And I think, too, when you look at it right now, where they're trying to redo the natural response plan. This is the fifth rewrite of this thing since DHS was created. We're in the middle of hurricane season. Now, this was a year ago that he said this. We're in the middle of hurricane season. They put out one without even talking to state and local governments. It shows that DHS is just completely dysfunctional. This is, of course, Michael Brown speaking of his former boss, Mr. Chertoff, who some are saying may be our next attorney general. But even perhaps more poignant is, last week, read The Tin Roof Blowdown, James Lee Burke's new book. James Lee Burke is one of my absolute favorite authors of all times. He is just, you know, totally brilliant. One of the finest authors, frankly, in our generation. I think of him. In fact, I said in the review, I think that this will be the review for BuzzFlash. It's going to go up in a day or two in the BuzzFlash.com review. I said he's the Hemingway of our generation, in my opinion. And in James Lee Burke's book, he tells the story. I mean, just very briefly, and I'll share both versions of this. This from James Lee Burke's book. This is a novel, by the way. The Dave Robichaux novel. I mean, it's just brilliant, and it takes place in New Orleans after the hurricane. And one of the characters is simply saying to the other, it just happens in passing. I mean, the novel is not a polemic at all. I mean, Burke's novels are all brilliant, but they're really all about the characters and the human condition. But here's this one character says, two police officers, a woman and a man, and the woman says to the guy, and the guy's the hero of the story, he's the viewpoint character. She says, "What'd you think of Lyndon Johnson?" she asked. He says, "Before or after I got to Vietnam?" And she says, "When Hurricane Betsy hit New Orleans in 65, Johnson flew into town and went into a shelter full of people who had been evacuated from Algiers. It was dark inside, and people were scared and didn't know what was going to happen to him. He shined a flashlight in his face and said, 'My name is Lyndon Baines Johnson. I'm your GD president, and I'm here to tell you my office and the people of the United States are behind you.' Not bad, huh?" And then the story, you know, but I wasn't listening. There was a detail about the Otis Baylor investigation that I hadn't mentioned to Helen. And it goes back into the novel, you know, and it just pops out for that, you know, one little sentence. And this is a story that David Remick wrote about back in October of 2005 for The New Yorker. His letter from Louisiana called High Water. And it starts out, "Russell Long, the son of Huey Long and an old friend of Johnson's in the Senate, had a simple goal. He wanted to convince the president of the urgency of the crisis and have him come immediately to Louisiana." This is Hurricane Betsy, September 10, 1965. Okay, and this is from the diaries, from Lyndon Johnson's daily diaries, the diaries of the phone conversations and everything. And they actually have the transcripts. Somebody sat down and transcribed these phone conversations. And Huey Long, "Mr. President, aside from the Great Lakes, the biggest lake in America is Lake Pontchartrain. It is now drained dry. That Hurricane Betsy picked the lake up and put it inside New Orleans in Jefferson Parish, the 3rd Congressional District. If I do say it, our people are just like, it's like my home. The whole damn home's been destroyed. But that's all right. My wife and kids are still okay, alive, so it's okay, Mr. President. But we really had it down here, and we need your help." Lyndon Johnson. Now, keep in mind, this is like within hours of the hurricane hitting. Lyndon Johnson, "All right, you got it." Huey Long, Senator Long, or excuse me, Russell Long, Senator Russell Long. "Mr. President, my people, oh, they're in tough shape." And then he talks about how, you know, you get down to Louisiana, it'll help your electoral chances. I mean, you know, you got to toss some politics in there. And he says, you got to get down here. And Johnson says, Lyndon Johnson, the president. He says, "Russell, I sure want to. I got a hell of a 2 days that I got scheduled. Let me look and see what I can get back out of and what I can get into and so forth and so on, and I'll give you a ring back. And if I can't go, I'll put the best man I've got there." Huey Long says, "Now listen, we're not the least bit interested in your best man. I'm just a Johnson man. And Johnson interrupts him and says, "I know that. I know that." Johnson hung up. He met with, and this is, you know, back to the story of the New Yorker. He met with Bill Moyers, Larry O'Brien, and J. Edgar Hoover and others, accepted an award from the leaders of the World Convention and the Churches of Christ. Then at 5:03 p.m., he boarded a helicopter on the South Lawn, ferried him to Andrews Air Force Base. From there, the president, along with Russell Long and Representative Hale Boggs, officials of the Red Cross and the Army Corps of Engineers, flew to New Orleans on Air Force One. In the Ninth Ward, even at the airport, Johnson began to get a sense of the damage wrought by Betsy. Parts of the roofing of the terminal were torn away and several large windows were broken. His diary reads, "The members of the presidential party had seen from the air a preview of the city." It goes on. In the Ninth Ward, Johnson visited the George Washington Elementary School on St. Claude Avenue, which is being used as a shelter. This is a quote from Lyndon Johnson's diary. "Most of the people inside and outside the building were Negro. At first, they did not believe that I was actually the president. Johnson entered the crowded shelter in near total darkness. There were only a couple of flashlights to lead the way. I am your president, Johnson announced. I am here to help you. The diary describes the shelter as a, quote, mass of human suffering, with people calling out for help in terribly emotional wails from voices of all ages. It is the most pitiful sight of human and material destruction. This is Lyndon Johnson's diaries. And he fixed it. He said, I'm here to help, and I'm going to fix it. Where was George Bush at the same time with Katrina? Eating cake with John McCain.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Back 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Now, I've been traveling around the country doing these openings for the 11th hour, and we're having a sneak peek tonight in Portland, Oregon, my hometown, and we actually have, I think there's 30 pairs of tickets still left that are on the front desk here at the Clear Channel Studios. So let me just call out to our listeners on KPOJ here in Portland, Oregon, that if you'd like to show up tonight, there are a limited number of free tickets, first come, first serve. Drop by the studios of 4949 Southwest McAdam, and the receptionist will give you a couple of free tickets to tonight's screening, and I'll be there afterwards doing a Q&A. It's going to be a lot of fun. Lyndon Johnson during Hurricane Betsy, 1965. He flies down in Air Force One. As soon as this thing happens, hops on a plane, flies down to Louisiana, a state, by the way, which he had lost in the previous election. Flies down there, and again, his diary. Actually, this is from Edward Haas, a historian who wrote in the Gulf Coast Historical Review an article about this. He said, Johnson was so deeply moved as people approached and asked him for food and for water. One woman asked Johnson for a boat so she could look for her two sons who had been lost in the flood. Johnson, tears in his eyes, turned to the mayor, who he referred to as Little Mayor. That was the phrase he used for the guy who was the mayor of the town at that time. I forget his name. Anyway, he says, Little Mayor, this is horrible. I've never seen anything like this in my life. Mayor Shiro is his name. He assured Shiro that the resources of the federal government were at his disposal and, quote, all red tape will be cut, end quote. And then, you know, again, quoting from the New Yorker article, the president, this is Lyndon Johnson, then flew back to Washington and the next day sent Shiro, this is the mayor, the next day sent him a 16-page telegram outlining plans for aid and the revival of New Orleans. Please know, Johnson wrote, this is Lyndon Johnson writing this, not some, you know, PR flag. Please know that my thoughts and prayers are with you and the thousands of Louisiana citizens who have suffered so heavily. Now, this is not to say Lyndon Johnson was a great guy and George Bush is a creep. That's not the point. The point is that there are two competing views of what kind of a society we live in, or we should live in, or we will live in the United States of America. As Michael Moore so brilliantly pointed out in his movie Sicko, are we going to live in a we society or are we going to live in a me society? And the we society view is the view that says we're all in this together, and the purpose, the reason why we organize government together, the reason why we do this is because all of us don't all have all the resources to be completely independent. In fact, the idea of any individual living totally independent, you know, the old Davy Boone coonskin cap going out to carve a new life out of the American Indian. To make a bad paraphrase of the old Firesign Theater joke. It's just a fantasy, you know, going out into the American wilderness and saying, yes, I'm going to, you know, come on. We are all interdependent. And that's the idea of American democracy. That's what came out of the Enlightenment. That's the idea of liberal democracy, is that we are all interdependent. There's a reason why we say we're going to have government answerable to us, being there when we fall through the net, when we fall through the holes, in a whole variety of ways, in a whole wide variety of ways. The Bush administration is running around. They're all excited right now. Poverty's down a little bit. Poverty has been going up every single year since Bush started his tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires and screw the rest of America program in 2001. 2000 was the last year that poverty dropped. Poverty dropped pretty steadily throughout Bill Clinton's administration and rose consistently over the last 5 years. This year it dropped a little bit, and the Bushies are going, see, it's all working. I'm sorry. Real wages are down over 2% since Bush came into office. Real wages have not gone up basically since Ronald Reagan declared war on working people in the 1980s. The social safety net, the fabric of this country, the we society, is in tatters. And Americans are horrified by it, frankly. Americans are looking at what happened, the mine disaster, for example. I mean, we find that this guy, he wouldn't even go to a nearby mine to get help because they were union miners. He went to a more distant mine to get non-union miners to help out. I mean, it's today, the story, from USA Today, scientists studying the collapse of the Utah mine that trapped six miners, that said Tuesday that all of the evidence, quote, all of the evidence from reviews of seismic readings overwhelmingly supports the conclusion that the collapse was caused by the mine and not an earthquake. But, you know, the stories continue, right? But this then goes back to the Mine Safety Administration being run by a guy who is a coal mining executive and another right-wing hack. And it makes perfect sense if you don't believe in government, that you can't govern, and that you would put into place, in these critical positions to protect other people, you would put into place people who see it as an opportunity to make money and to basically steal things. And that's what the Republicans have been doing for 26 years now. And it makes perfect sense that we as Americans would say, enough. We've had enough. We want our country back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour. This is interesting. The New York Times today is counsel. Thompson walked Capitol's fine line. Fred Thompson is particularly interesting. Mr. Thompson was an active participant in Richard Nixon's White House efforts to deflect blame from the president and discredit his accusers, plotting strategy with Mr. Nixon's lawyers and leaking them information. In 1994, he was handpicked by the Republican leadership to investigate Democratic fundraising scandals involving Bill Clinton's 1996 reelection campaign. Instead, he infuriated conservative groups and many of his colleagues by widening the investigation to include Republican improprieties. Well, that's interesting. Jeez. Even threatening to quit if forced to abandon his bipartisan goal. So, well, I don't know. Who knows about Fred Thompson? It's an interesting situation, interesting time to be alive, isn't it? It's just fascinating. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ralph in Jackson, Michigan. Hey, Ralph, welcome to the program. Ralph?
Rob?
Yeah.
Okay, that's close enough. Didn't realize it was me. Anyway, yeah. Tom, I was just getting done with this book by Chomsky and Achar, and it's one of those things where the conservative view, and it's very idealistic, and it sounds really good, but these people do not realize, you know, it's great for the millionaires, the billionaires, and everybody else, but the whole thing is the way that the policies are written, every time a conservative votes conservative, these people are getting kicked in the face.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what's even more ironic and what's more amazing, Ralph, thanks, and you make a good point, is that a CEO pay, I mean, there's a new study out today on CEO pay, and CEO pay in the United States is a little short of 400 times the average worker pay among you know, the larger corporations in America. And hundreds of millions of dollars in many cases. And in Japan, right now, as we speak, CEO pay is 11 times average worker pay. In the United Kingdom, right now as we speak, CEO pay is 20 times average worker pay. Now, why would that be? And by the way, does that mean that the Japanese companies are less competitive? No! Does that mean that the British companies are less competitive? No! What it means is that they have a progressive income tax system where when you start making absurd, obscene amounts of money, far more, you know, frankly, than is necessary for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yeah, oh my God, he's talking about social engineering. Yes, sure. That when you have a progressive taxation system, what it does is it builds a middle class. And that's a good and healthy thing for democracy. And when you destroy it, as Ronald Reagan did, then you go back into the age, into the Gilded Age, you go back into the age of the robber barons, as we are right now. Steve in Atascadero, California.
That's
Am I pronouncing
me.
That right?
Atascadero. How you doing?
Atascadero. Ah, great.
Yeah, I really want to thank you for doing what you do, and I've been listening only for a few months, but every single day since I started, and it's just really amazing the things that you are bringing to light. I have a comment briefly on this recent census report about less people living in poverty and how the Bushies are all touting it as some kind of a turnaround. It seems quite obvious to me. I'd like to know what your thoughts are, but what about those people? I mean, don't you think they might have just dropped off the scale? They don't exist anymore because of...
Well, one of the folks in the chat room said there's probably fewer people being measured in poverty because more and more of them are in prison. I mean,
yeah,
we now have the largest...
Yeah, more are in prison and more are dead.
Yeah, and, yeah. Well, your point well taken. 18,000 people a year, according to the federal government's very conservative statistics, die as a result of lack of health insurance. And I think that that's just the very smallest tip of the iceberg. But you know, even assuming that poverty has gone down slightly, still, what we're seeing is, and it's in these same statistics, by the way, is that the middle class is getting smaller. And the people are being pressed harder and harder and harder, and it's just a true tragedy. Steve, thanks for the call and for your kind words. Dennis in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Dennis.
Mr. Hartman, I want to echo Steve's sentiments about gratitude for everything you've done. You're the first person who's been able to excite me into wanting to take action. With that said, it's almost impossible for somebody like me to be able to get the time and the money to be able to go to Washington and march on Washington for any organized march. So I had this idea. Imagine if someone like you, who has this large audience, picked a date on the calendar that you thought would be the best date for us to report to our own respective state capitals. I could easily take the day off work and go there. And imagine what it would do if on the same day, all across the country, people were all standing in front of their state capitals protesting this war or this occupation of Iran, of Iraq, demanding the impeachment of Bush and Cheney, the criminal prosecution of Alberto Gonzalez. What do you think about that?
It's a great idea, and if the problem is it would take a national organization, somebody like Move On, to really take it on and push it, and you and I aren't that organization. At the moment that we start thinking that the only way we're going to make things happen is if we can get a million people in the streets, that's the moment we've lost, because it's really not about that. The million people in the streets is a symptom of something else. Rosa Parks, you know, refusing to take to move back on the bus. Rosa Parks had been working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee for 12 years. She had been through all these training programs. She was an activist. She'd been showing up for things. I mean, Paul Loeb in his book, I forget which one of his books it is now, but Paul Loeb writes about this so eloquently and speaks about this so eloquently. There, by the time it became mass demonstrations, it was the consequence of hundreds of thousands of small efforts, small local efforts, groups of 5 and 10 people. And that's really, you know, that's happening. But that we need more and more of that. The Democracy for America stuff, the meetups, the drinking liberally stuff, the people showing up when their member of Congress shows up and showing up at the town halls and swapping business cards and saying, hey, let's all meet at Manny Maloof's Tavern at 9 o'clock next Thursday and that kind of thing. And that eventually is what leads to those mass mobilizations. So I think that instead of saying let's you and I, Dennis, conspire or whatever, you know, in a positive way, to create some kind of mass mobilization, let's instead do as much as we can at the local level, and ultimately everything else will flow out of that. Does that make sense?
But isn't our state capital local?
Yeah, it is. And I certainly would encourage I would encourage you in Michigan, to try to get people to Lansing on a particular day if you can pull together the organization, and I think, you know, others all around, and even doing it, like I said, even doing it as a national thing and doing it at the state capitol is a great idea. It's just that it's, you know, we you and I can't right now declare that it's going to happen.
But I bet if a guy like you with an audience like yours looked at the calendar and said, I don't know, September 16th seems like a good day to me, then if all your listeners said, well, on September 16th, do or die, I'm going to at least go. And if somebody else shows up, great. And if they don't, then they don't. But imagine, I mean, if a whole bunch of people who can hear the sound of your voice today heard that date and said, I like what Dennis said. I like that Tom Hartman picked that date. I'm going to call in sick that day and drive to my state capitol and be there with my sign. And if I'm alone, I'm alone. And if I'm not, I'm not. And if it happened all across the country.
Well, let me. Here's what I think is a more. And Dennis, thank you for the call. Your point is well taken. And you know, but I'm not the guy to do that. But Cenk Uygur with the Young Turks made this comment. I just a comment in passing about a month or two ago about he's had enough, and he's just going to go out and stand out. You know, he's going to encourage other people to just go out and stand someplace with a sign on Sunday that says enough. And I'm driving down the street in Portland on Sunday, and here's all over the city. Not thousands of people, but you know, there's a half a dozen street corners that, as we're looking for a place to have breakfast, where there's people standing there with, you know, like 3-4 people standing there with a sign that says, enough. And every Sunday, there's people out there saying that. And that's, you know, that kind of viral thing, that's really, in my opinion, where we really need to begin. I think that's the starting point on the whole thing. Gwyneth in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Gwyneth, what's up?
Hi. Well, I have two comments now, if that's all right. One is in response to Dennis. Mm-hmm. And if MoveOn organized it and you announced it, I would say let's not go to the front of our state capitol, but let's go into the rotundas and through all the office passageways. And
National Day of Lobbying.
Well, we did that in our state capitol here in Oregon, and it got $30 million out of the legislature for health care that they weren't planning to spend in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's that comment. But what I called you about is to talk to you about CEOs and their 400 times pay, and our elected officials who aren't making that much money, but these people who are put in positions of supposedly being responsible, I think they need to be held to be accountable, which means to me that they aren't allowed to say, I can't recall or I don't remember, that they lose their jobs, that they lose their money if they are held responsible for actions that harm other people.
Yeah. Specifically, for example, the guy who ran the coal mine in Utah, is that what you had in mind?
Yeah, take his money away and all his assets. And old Ken Lay, who's supposedly dead now, take all his assets away. And there's many, many others who just take all their business offshore and leave whole communities devastated. They ought to just, if we can change our rules.
We used to call people like that sociopaths. I mean, you know, in our society, we used to look at CEOs who laid off people and offshored their companies just to increase their own profits and their own paychecks and think very poorly of them. And ever since Reagan came into office, and declared that greed was good and you know, the new era of the robber barons had begun and the grand, you know, no more of this Jimmy Carter walking to your inaugural ball stuff. We're going to do it in limousines and caddies. It's been all downhill ever since. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
By the way, don't forget, this Friday, I'll be on C-SPAN. We'll be doing the show live, noon to 3 Eastern Time. Check your local listings. This Friday, August 31st. And also today, starting in about 10 minutes, the Discovery Times channel, at least according to national listings, again, check your local listings, is carrying a one-hour documentary based on a movie that Lamar Waldron and I wrote about John and Robert Kennedy and Fidel Castro and all kinds of interesting things. Chris in New Milford, New Jersey. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just let you know, in response to the caller last time talking about the demonstrations where we wanted to get a million people rallied together,
mm-hmm.
The Answer Coalition is planning already on having a large, massive demonstration in Washington, D.C. on September 15th. You can check that out by going to sept15.org.
Right. Now, isn't that something that's running like an entire week, and you're also going to have things going on the weekend of the 22nd, the 23rd, through the entire, or is that just a one-day thing?
Oh, no, it's going to be a whole week-long demonstration. So you can go to the website and find out the whole litany of events that they have going on there.
Yeah, okay. And the website, once again, is?
sept15.org.
Oh, as in September.
As in September15.org.
Right.
And you can go there.
.org. Okay, yep. Great. Thanks a lot for the heads up, Chris. I appreciate
you,
that. And who knows? Maybe I'll even be able to get out there for some little bit of it. We'll see how these things go. I was in Washington D.C. For the last big demonstration, and in fact marched part of the way downtown with Michael Lerner. But anyhow, we'll see. Ethan in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ethan.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, is that Ethan, our 13-year-old regular listener here to KPOJ?
Yes, it is.
And local activist.
Yes.
Progressive activist. Well, hello, Ethan. What's on your mind today?
I am also calling about what Dennis said about how getting people to come out and do things like protest in mass numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if people do what he did, which is call up radio stations and just tell everyone about like an idea that they have that would be across the country and like have a day, and then if everyone like start listens and thinks, oh, that's a good idea, that they do that and tell their friends about it, then it could spread all across the nation and it would actually happen, and it might make an actual difference.
Yeah, the key to it is viralizing it, Ethan. And thank you. Good point. Well said. This is the thing that concerns me: is salvationist thinking, essentially, is thinking that something else is going to save us. We just need the perfect leader. We just need the right talk show host to say the right thing at the right time. We just need the right organization to say, oh yeah, we're going to do this then, and everything is going to solve. And it doesn't, it's never worked that way. You know, when people get out in front of things, whether it's politicians or for that matter, whether it's a talk show host or an author or a website or an organization like Move On, whatever, it is not typically because they said, oh, gee, I've got a great idea. I'm going to lead this movement. In fact, it almost never works when you try to lead a movement like that. Instead, it's because a lot of people have gotten involved. I'm looking at the September 15th, SEPT 15. Website, and a lot of stuff going on all the way through the following weekend, and you know, that first weekend I'm coming back from Germany then, but there's just a lot going on, and in Washington D.C. for example, I mean there's other things, I mean, but just going out on a Sunday with your sign that says enough, you know, it just seems like a good starting point. Steve in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Steve.
Good morning, Tom. I don't want to rain on Ethan's parade and Dennis's parade, but as an old veteran of the anti-Vietnam War movement and a lot of environmental protest movements as well, I just don't see the effectiveness of so-called mass rallies. What I do see, Tom, is an infrastructural work, and you allude to this
right.
Many times
well,
by saying.
Well, if I may, Steve, interrupt you just for a second. But where, you know, and also speaking as somebody who was, you know, in SDS back in the late '60s, and part of that, you know, the anti-war movement, that the benefit of the mass movements is that you get to network with other people. and that you get ideas that you can take back to your local community. But it's, I, frankly, as I said, I don't think the mass movement is the thing. I think it's the symptom of the thing.
Absolutely. And I would say, to the extent that we can act in a local way, thinking globally, as the bumper sticker says, but acting locally, I think our power is far greater on the local level than if we talk about remote protests in Washington or even Sacramento or, any other state capital. When people band together locally, they have far much more concentrated power and the ability to get the attention of their local officials.
Right, and it doesn't even have to be banding together locally in an angry way. It can be getting together with one of the drinking liberally organizations and having a beer with a half a dozen people. And I mean, that's how the American Revolution started. It started with five guys sitting in Sam Adams' bar. And this is how these things happen. Steve, thank you for the call. Brendan in West Bloomfield, Michigan. Just a half a minute or so before we have to wrap this hour, Brendan.
All right, thanks. I wanted to talk about what you were talking earlier about the We and Me Society.
Yeah.
And I've always enjoyed listening to your program because you put modern politics in a historical and perspective and a perspective of political philosophy. And I just feel that that's gotten, it's gotten lost in this country when we try and talk about what's my role in society, what's the greater role of society. I hear a lot of people talking from a perspective of what they feel rather than what they think.
Yeah. Yeah, and interesting point. I just think Michael Moore's meme, and thank you, Brendan, I think Michael Moore's meme of, do we want to live in a we society or a me society? I thought that was the most important part of the entire movie, of the movie Sicko. It's just absolutely brilliant. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Breaking news here. General Musharraf of Pakistan says he's going to drop his role as the chief of the army. And apparently, and we talked about this 2-3 weeks ago, I was saying, wouldn't it be a great thing if Benazir Bhutto came back? She's not the most squeaky clean politician in the world, but nonetheless, some semblance of democracy. She has a lot of support in Pakistan. If she were allowed to come back into the country and run for president, and it looks like, well, this is the first paragraph of the piece on the front page of the New York Times here online. Under the terms of the deal, President Pervez Musharraf would serve again as president, and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto would return to Pakistan to contest elections. So it's interesting. This may be a very positive step forward for Pakistan, and that would be a good thing for the region. It would be a good thing for democracy. Might be some good news. Might be some good news. Yeah, so we'll see. Michael Crowley is with us. He's the senior editor at the New Republic magazine and a contributing editor to Reader's Digest. RD.com is the Reader's Digest website. And Michael Crowley, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
You have a new article here. I believe this is in Reader's Digest, wasn't it?
Yes, it is.
To injury?
That's right.
Yeah, titled "That's Outrageous." And rather than trying to tell the point of the story, let you. What's outrageous?
Okay. Well, this one, this is a regular column I do, and we find these kind of crazy things that you sort of find are hard to believe really happening out there, there's always a surplus of stories that kind of make you slap your forehead and say, how did that happen? This is one of the better ones I've encountered. And it basically has to do, it has a very serious element to it, although it's in some ways it's kind of wacky, but it's veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who are basically swamping the system of veterans benefits, people who really need help. The system is getting totally overloaded. And it turns out that at the same time you have guys coming back from war with severe disabilities that have left them basically non-functional in many ways, the Veterans Affairs system is handing out large amounts of money to people with maladies that include hemorrhoids, STDs like herpes and gonorrhea, and a lot of minor things like scars, arthritis, and hypertension, many of these being conditions that really had nothing to do with people's military service. So what you have on the one hand is a veterans benefit system that kind of got a little bit out of control and started giving money to people for things that had nothing to do with their military service on the one hand. And now on the other, the system is completely swamped and unable to deal with people who really need help. And if you'll just give me about 20 more seconds, I'll just tell you that the kind of example I built the column around was a guy I talked to from Georgia named James Webb. He was an Army specialist, and he basically got blown up in Fallujah. And he had devastating injuries. He had brain trauma, spinal cord damage, and post-traumatic stress disorder. He came home totally unable to work, but it took him 10 months to try to get his claim processed for disability benefits. He ran out of money. He was basically homeless. He was contemplating suicide. So at the same time, this guy is contemplating suicide and has a brain trauma and can't get any benefits. Guys are getting checks for hemorrhoids, STDs, and arthritis that had nothing to do with their military service. So something's out of whack here, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, really, you know, the argument is made, and Larry Scott made it very eloquently some months ago. He runs VAWatchdog.org, which is, in my opinion, one of the very best of the veterans sites out there, that the Veterans Administration, you know, I said to Larry, why don't we just, you know, say to all veterans, you guys are now part of Medicare. You're now covered by Medicare. And, you know, if the deal is you serve in the military and you get medical services in exchange for that. And his point was that, well, that's not quite the deal. First of all, you don't just get free medical care for the rest of your life if you serve in the military. And secondly, right, that these have to be service-connected disabilities. And service-connected disabilities are typically very unique. I mean, it's the kind of medical care that's necessary for somebody who has had a leg blown off is different than the kind of medical care that you typically see in a normal hospital where somebody shows up with a staph infection or they have an appendicitis or something. And
right,
so military hospitals by necessity have a certain level of specialization that leans more toward war-based trauma. And therefore, it makes good sense that we maintain a Veterans Administration system that is a military hospital and medical system specifically for people who are suffering from, you know, war-related or military-related injuries. What you're pointing out, it seems to me, is less an indictment of the VA system, although there's an obvious and clear indictment of the fact of the failure to fund this program right now by these guys who are borrowing $1 trillion to fight this war, but not, you know, not doing much for the people who are doing the fighting.
Right.
But more an indictment of the failure of our national healthcare system to provide for the needs of people broadly who have medical needs who may also happen to be veterans. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, that's definitely part of it, and I think your analysis of why the VA system it should be kind of a unique thing is a very persuasive one. It's not a question I studied for this article, but I think that it sounds spot on that there is very specialized treatment. But, you know, what I see here basically, you're right, and I don't think there's a huge indictment of the VA system per se. The other thing I would just add is that I think that what you've had is it's been a little bit of a pander. Congress has basically broadened the ability of veterans to bring claims that were not related to their military service to get coverage for things that the system was never meant to cover. And look, I'm not going to stand up and say we should be trying to balance the budget on the backs of veterans who have arthritis or even hemorrhoids, which is not funny if you have it, I guess. You know, I think those people should have good health care. The problem is that on the other hand, at the same time, they were sort of expanding the system for these marginal claims, there was a complete failure to prepare for what the system was going to have to deal with in Iraq and Afghanistan. And of
course, but the simple reality is that one of the reasons why that there was a pressure to expand that system is because, hey, here's
yes,
a healthcare system in a nation that doesn't have a friggin' healthcare system.
Okay.
I mean,
quite gotten your point at first, and I think that's a great point. You're right, that these people need that marginal help. That's right, because it's not easy.
That's right. If we were to simply say everybody in the United States is covered by Medicare tomorrow, and we have a national single-payer healthcare system, period, Oh, and by the way, we're still running the Veterans Administration program for those people who have service-related disabilities, because it's specialized to service-related disabilities, because in the majority of cases, things like, you know, combat-related post-traumatic stress disorder or combat-related, you know, injuries, physical injuries, there are these very highly specialized forms of medicine that are needed. So we're still running the Veterans Administration program for service-related disabilities, but for people who are veterans, you get health care just like everybody else. And so if you have a sexually transmitted disease, or even if you got it in Vietnam back in 76, or if you've got hemorrhoids, or if you've got whatever, then you know you're entitled to health care just like every other American is. And that would take the pressure off the VA system. I mean, frankly, what I see in your article is an indictment of the fact that the United States is the only one of 38 industrialized nations in the world, the top 38 industrialized nations in the world, that doesn't have a national health care system.
Well, let me,
and
let
as
me
a consequence of that, people who just happen to be vets are going, hey, you know, I've got health care needs, legitimate health care needs, and I'm going to get them met however I possibly can. And if the VA is the only way, then I'm going to go for it. Well, and who can blame them?
Yeah, I think that may be what's happening. And I would just point out one other kind of big picture thing is that at the end of the day, you're right. You know, you can't blame these guys. They want benefits. Health care is hard to come by. I am not trying to pick on veterans. The macro point here that people should understand, there is a backlog right now of 600,000 claims, veterans disability claims before the VA. The average waiting period for a vet's claim right now is about 6 months. And appealing a denied claim, and there are lots of horror stories about claims that were wrongly denied or carelessly denied.
Right, particularly the PTSD ones.
Years.
Yeah, nearly 2 years,
so,
and particularly those with regard to post-traumatic stress disorder. That's one of the areas where the Bush administration, particularly the VA under Jim Nicholson, was starting to get very aggressive about trying to deny people claims,
yeah.
Simply and cravenly to save money. You know, just because they didn't want to have to spend money, and it's a system that is not, it's not so much a broken system as a tragically underfunded system, because here we've got, again, a bunch of guys governing who don't believe in government. And how can you govern if you don't believe in government? Anyhow, Michael Crowley, senior editor of the New Republic magazine, contributing editor to Reader's Digest. You can read his new piece, his column over at readersdigestrd.com. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a million. Pleasure doing it.
Good thought-provoking conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. Larissa Alexandrovna up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
I'm American. I'm American. I respect you and your point of view. I'm American. I'm American. And I wish you good fortune with whatever you do.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larissa Alexandrovna is with us. She is the managing editor for Raw Story's investigative news team, rawstory.com, the website. Larissa, welcome to the program.
Hi. Nice, thanks for having me.
It's always great having you on, Larissa. You're one of the very best investigative reporters out there.
Thank you.
Your work always blows my mind. And this in particular, I mean, sometimes shockingly, U.S. preparing massive military attack against Iran.
Yes. Well, it's well beyond preparing. It's well on its way. It is a report that two British security experts put together as kind of a connect the dots using open source news reports over the last couple of years, but also their own sourcing. And they've put together this report, which is as you say, very shocking, and does blow my mind as well. The only thing I would add that some of their assertions, at least in my lay opinion, is that they optimistically estimate the successful strategic bombing of nuclear sites. Whereas the reality would be quite different, I would think.
Well, I have no doubt we can successfully strategically drop bombs. The question is, you know, what kind of blowback is going to come from it? First of all, I was talking on this program yesterday about this, and I've been talking about this for a week or two, that Andy Card, back in 2002, when he was asked if we were going to invade Iraq, he said, we don't roll out a new product in the summer. We wait until the fall.
Right.
And I said, wait until the first week of September. Wait until after Labor Day, and you're going to hear these guys. But it's already starting. This is George W. Bush yesterday.
Iran has arrested visiting American scholars who have committed no crimes and pose no threat to their regime. And Iran's active pursuit of technology that could lead to nuclear weapons threatens to put a region already known for instability and violence under the shadow of a nuclear holocaust.
Well, first of all, he's still mispronouncing nuclear, but...
I think he's in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, but so...
But you did hear the rest of it, where he goes, and I quote, I'm reading from my notes on this, I will take all the actions necessary to protect our troops. I have authorized our military commanders in Iraq to confront Tehran's murderous activities. That's a declaration of war.
Yeah. Well, it quite literally is, actually.
Yes. No, I mean, quite and actually, literally, yes, it is.
So how do you, you know, I mean, you've got some very, very good contacts on the inside. How do you see this thing playing out? What exactly do you think is going to happen?
Well, the thing is, you know, it was supposed to really play out in March of last year, and then something changed. And then again towards the summer of last year, and then something changed. So I have been reluctant until it started to, there's a lot of heavy leaking again, and alarming leaking. And basically at this point, I'm convinced they are going to hit Iran. When? I don't know. I can't speculate on that. But I was just talking to a really, really a high-level person earlier today, and I said, well, you know, is there a way we can – is there somehow this can be stopped? Is there some way – impeachment? Is there anyone who can talk sense into these people? And my source said, no one can stop this now. No one.
This is like Germany before Hitler attacked Poland.
Poland, right. I mean, it's already, we know that the covert ops have been going on for quite some time. I've reported on it. Cy Hirsch has reported on it. We've been arming, you know, various proxy groups. But what, you know, the new things that are going on, and I reported on this last week, is the CIA appears to have a different directive at this point. And very recently. And I'm not told the specifics of the directive, but it's different from what we already know they're allowed to be doing. That is to say, we already know that they've been given approval to conduct black propaganda and financial kind
sabotage,
of...
sabotage, assassinations?
No, not quite assassinations.
Oh, we're funding the mech group to do that inside Iran.
Right, but that's coming out of military. That's not coming out of the CIA. The CIA has been stripped of all ability to act in that way under this administration. Those operations were, you know, comparatively mild to one what... to what we have, you know, come to expect from the CIA. That has now changed, and something else is going on now. And whatever that else is, I don't know the particulars, but it's new and it's aggressive. And so if you take that, plus the president basically declaring war, plus the sudden arrest of Iranians in Iraq yesterday.
Right. It all becomes 2+2, yeah. It's terrible. Larissa Alexandrovna, you can read all about it over at rawstory.com. The whole story, all the details. U.S. preparing massive military attack against Iran. Larissa, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Yes, if you want to, you got to run. Only if you want to.
Well, on a little bit lighter side. Or maybe it's not. I don't know. Maybe it's like all the same mentality. It's, you know, it's Bomberan and spank your wife? I mean, what's this? Now, this is actually a serious story. It's over at Alternet. Ann Friedman writing, what if your wife, even after graduating the prestigious homemaking course at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary with a degree in ladylike submission, still won't behave? Well, uber-conservative Christian patriarchs everywhere now have a solution. Give her a good spanking. This is, I'm not kidding you, this is... It's called a Christian domestic discipline marriage. They have come up with a new kind of marriage. Yeah, I mean, we thought we'd seen it all, right? There'd been open marriages, there's gay marriages, there's all the... Now they have the CDD marriages. A Christian domestic discipline marriage is one set up according to biblical standards. That is, the husband is the authority in the household. He has the authority to spank his wife for punishment. But CDD is so much more than just spanking. It is the husband loving the wife enough to guide and teach her. I'm actually quoting from their stuff. And then, just to make it very strange, they say, though we recognize that by its very nature this subject be erotic, we will try to keep this website as clean and wholesome as possible. And what if she says, no, I don't want to be spanked? Well, then there's non-consensual CDD. And it's just really and truly... crazy. So anyhow, speaking of spankings, by the way,
naughty boy, bad boy, a naughty boy, a nasty, bad, naughty boy.
Yes, Larry Craig. Oh man, how could we forget Larry Craig? Anyhow, back to the serious business here. Judy in Orange County, California, you wanted to talk about what happens if we bomb Iran.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, by the way. I just got so frightened. I realize Iran is partners with, through their oil, with China, Russia. what are they doing?
Well, they've also signed a mutual non-aggression pact and a mutual defense treaty with Iraq.
That's right.
I mean, right now, legally, if we bomb Iran, Iraq is legally required by treaty to attack us.
That's right. And
this could be a World War I. I mean, this is like assassinating Archduke Ferdinand. Pardon my interrupting you.
No, that's all right. And you know, there is a reason why Russia is now patrolling Alaska area and the North Pole. I mean, there has to be a reason why all of a sudden they have their equivalent to AWACS up there.
Putin put his AWACS up 24/7 with nuclear weapons 2 weeks
ago. Exactly. I mean, this is absolutely insane. Our government is totally insane. I am so new. My children are not, well, my oldest son will be 40, but, you know, they could draft him. My grandsons in 5 years will be old enough for the draft. I am so frightened. I am so scared. I don't know what to do.
What to do, Judy, is, and what we all need to do right now, is we all need, first of all, take a deep breath and remember Franklin Roosevelt's, you know, we're not, fear is not the way. And the negative emotions that are typically associated with something like, you know, looking at what the Bush administration is doing, we need to turn into activism. We need to turn it into positive action.
Yes.
Yeah, and that means, you know, just the old generic stuff, contacting your elected members of Congress and saying, you know, if what I'm hearing is true and the Bush administration is going to attack Iran, please do everything you can to stop it. Judy, I've got to move along, but thank you for the call. I share your concern. Let's never forget. I mean, we had Scott Ritter on this program a year and a half ago, and he said in March, this was in October, November, December, of the year before last, and he said the following March, which would have been March of last year, and he said in March of this year that the attack was going to happen. We had Seymour Hersh on this program around the same time. He was operating from the same intelligence. There's going to be an attack in the spring. There's this little window of opportunity when the moon is just right and all this, and it's going to happen. And it didn't happen. And nobody knows why. But what we do know is that for about 3 or 4 weeks there, you couldn't turn on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, any of the mainstream, in quotes, media, without hearing some neocon right-winger talking about how terrible Iran was and they're coming to get us. And then all of a sudden, as if somebody had just flipped a switch, they all stopped talking about it at the same time, almost on the same day. And it went real quiet for a while, and now it's starting up again. And you ask, you know, some ask why. Well, you know, obviously there's oil. I think it's also really important that we remember that this is the election. This is not an election year, but for all practical purposes, it is. The election process has already begun way, way early. The primaries are happening way, way early. And remember, now, Dick Cheney may have wanted to get into this war in Iraq in order for his buddies to make hundreds of billions of dollars, and they have. And many of Bush's funders may have wanted him to get into the war in Iraq so that they could make money and so that they could get oil. But Bush himself had a very different motivation. This is Cindy Sheehan's testimony before John Conyers Commission, before Congress, under oath, speaking about what Mickey Herskowitz, the guy who wrote the first draft of Bush's autobiography, A Charge to Keep, a book you can find in bookstores today, what Bush told him. Oh, and it always helps if I turn
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
So what I see forming here is a coalition of Republicans who want there to be a war in Iran because it will galvanize the country. It'll terrify the Democrats in their opinion. You know, it's, who's going to speak against the administration during time of war? I mean, the Republicans are still remembering how well this worked for Franklin Roosevelt. And it's just, I mean, so you've got this political equation, plus you've got the geopolitical equation. We've made an absolute mess of Iraq. And if we pull out of Iraq, and we're going to have to pull out of Iraq in the spring because we have a totally broken army. I mean, the only two options, militarily speaking, the only two options are either pull out of Iraq or institute the draft. Because we just, you know, we're out of soldiers. And we're burning them out. And they're not going to institute a draft. It would be political suicide. And if we pull out of Iraq, there's concern that Iran, which yesterday or day before yesterday, Ahmadinejad said, you know, there's going to be a political power vacuum in Iraq when the United States leaves. It's a majority Shiite country. We're Shiites. We're willing to step in and help, you know, maintain order and peace. And who knows? It may ultimately be a better thing than what they have right now. But the fact of the matter is that the Bushies are looking at this going, oh, boy, we're going to have to take out both these countries. Tracy in Houston, Texas. Hey, Tracy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. You know what? I honestly think that we will be going to war with Iran. You know, I notice how when Bush says ominous things about something, we end up going in that path. You know, I hate to think when he says we're going into a recession. When he first got in office, and I'm like, wait a minute, we got a surplus. And sure enough, it looked like he's heading us in that direction. But when it comes to Iraq, you know, we attack because weapons of mass destruction, nothing there. Now Al-Qaeda, now it's Iran. And I can't help but think of what Hillary Clinton, you know, said. It's just almost like she had inside information with respect to if we're attacked or if we're at war, the Republicans are not the party to lead us. And I'm kind of matching that because I looked yesterday and I saw how Bush was saying how pretty much we're going to protect our interests. Pretty much like the woman a couple of calls before said, he made a declaration of war. And to
right.
me,
and then you've got Sean Hannity yesterday attacking Hillary Clinton for saying that she's made a secret deal with Al-Qaeda. I mean, this is because the Republicans get it, that if they can have more war, it will benefit them. And that's what Hillary Clinton was saying. And by saying it, by putting it out there out loud, she actually would diminish the power that, you know, would accrue to the Republicans. It would make it look like a craven political strategy on their part. And so now they're trying to punish her. They're trying to push back.
This is a true wag the dog as well, because I think it's so many different factors. One, I really feel supply and demand. If Bush attacks Iran, that could almost trigger, like the other couple callers said, it could trigger World War III because Russia, China. Now that means Saudi would be the biggest winner, and Bush is in bed with the Saudis. So, and then he might be impeached. All his party, Gonzalez, Rope, they've all left. So this war could be also a distraction from impeaching him or going after him or pursuing him.
Yeah.
So it's so many elements, there's so many factors working here. I don't know, but it looks like he could, especially if he gets this money from Congress. What do you want, $50 billion now?
Right. So, if he truly is a sociopath, if this guy really and truly is a mass killer, if this guy really and truly is willing to kill hundreds of thousands or millions of people purely for political purposes, as he told his biographer in 1999 he was, then attacking Iran is just the next logical step.
And we need to go after Mark. Thanks a lot for the time, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tracy. It is a time for us to be speaking out and to be speaking out loudly and saying, you know, war is not the way. Defensive war, of course, we wanted to stop Hitler. But have we turned things around to the point that we have become the aggressors? Is the United States behaving now the way that Germany did before it attacked Poland? It certainly is starting to seem that way. Well, it has for some time, and we need to call it out. We just need to call it out. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Just a mile off the road. Take it in, take it with you when you go.
I'll always carry that good feeling. Hey, by the way, don't forget, on Friday I'll be on live on C-SPAN, noon to 3 Eastern Time. Check your local listings as this Friday, August 31st. Ellen Ratner's on the line with us with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
The president is in the Gulf Coast today, and of course it is the second anniversary of Katrina, something I actually know something about as opposed to
you and Charlene have been down there working your butts off, doing relief work down there. You know, there's two things I want to just real quickly toss at you and get your take on, in addition to all the, because I know you always come in like, you know, with a fire hydrant full of news. Number one, I opened the show actually by reading about how LBJ in 1965 with Hurricane Betsy went down to New Orleans, walked into a shelter. There were no lights. People were terrified. They were crying. They were freaking out. He said, "Don't worry, I'm the president. We're going to do something." I mean, he literally got on a plane the next day with Russell Long and flew down there. And they said, "Who the hell are you?" And he put a flashlight in his own face. He says, "I'm the GD, you know, president of the United States. I'm Lyndon Baines Johnson, and I'm telling you, we're going to do something about this." And he was so freaked out. The next day, he had a 16-page fax that he sent down about, you know, we're going to cut all the red tape. We're going to solve the problem. And he did. I mean, that's what a president really does who really cares. And here we are 2 years out, and George Bush has done virtually nothing. A disaster A. B, I'd like to get your thoughts on what's happening with Pakistan and Musharraf. And C, Larissa Alexandrovna from Raw Story was just on. She said there's that the Cy Hirsch stuff about, you know, the we're going to attack Iran, it's back, and they're preparing any day now. I'm just wondering, you know, let me just toss
the easy stuff first, and that is... That, yes, it's certainly back in terms of the Iranian situation. And don't forget, yesterday, the president made a speech, and he basically said if we withdrew, it would help Iran and it would help Al-Qaeda. And then, of course, he's planning on coming back to Congress for another $50 billion. So that's very much on the table.
Attack of Iran.
He's mentioned it in his speeches. I mean, what?
Right. Is there any kind of, you know, conventional wisdom emerging or consensus emerging in Washington, D.C. that these guys are actually going to attack Iran very, very soon, or that there may be an attack by some third country, for example, Israel, that we would support?
You know, I just find it so unbelievable that he would do it, that I find it above my mental health to believe that he would actually do that. On the other hand, He has surprised me many, many times in that arena. So people in Washington at this point are not really talking about it, but that does not mean, but I'm hearing it so much that it's feeling to me like the pre-days before Iraq.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, when you begin to hear it in speeches, et cetera. Now, let me just talk to you about Benazir Bhutto, who I have actually, I spent quite a bit of time with her about 3 years ago. She was visiting a friend in Potomac, Maryland, and I went out to where she was on a snowy day and interviewed her and really spent quite a bit of time with her. And what she said to me at that time is, look, Musharraf is letting terrorism exist. He says one thing to the United States, and he does another. And so I think that her support, and she has quietly gathered her support over the years, is really quite strong there. And, you know.
Particularly among the secularists.
That's right.
Among the people who want to have a non, you know, fanatical government.
And she is not into fanatics in any way, shape, or form. My cousin went to Harvard with her when they called her Pinky. She went to Radcliffe. So, she always wore pink. And, she's just not into the radical extremist thing in any way, shape, or form. I mean, yes, she had an arranged marriage and all that kind of thing, but she sort of had to.
Well, she's a product of her culture, but the bottom line then, in your opinion, Musharraf stepping down as head of the military and allowing Benazir Bhutto to come back into the country and contest the elections is my take on it an hour ago when it broke was that this is a really good thing.
Well, not only is it a good thing, but don't forget, the United States was preparing to take that guy out in C-130s, and we heard that from a very reliable source.
We were looking at a Shah of Iran scenario.
Right, the Shah of Iran scenario with Musharraf, and this may be the only way that there is any possibility of not having that whole situation happen before our eyes.
Might it help stabilize the area in a way that it would either prevent us from attacking Iran or that would ameliorate the effects of a limited airstrike on Iran?
If there was a possibility that they could really root out terrorism, the really crazy guys out of there. And
right.
I don't know enough about Pakistan to know whether that could happen or not. I do know
It just seems to me if we drop bombs on Iran that Pakistan's going to explode. The entire Arab world is going to
explode. Well, of course.
The Muslim world is going to
explode. It would destabilize everything. Completely destabilize.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You just said, I do know one, I interrupted you.
Well, I know that it's interesting when they had all their problems, last year with the earthquake, et cetera, we sent our staff person, I couldn't go because of my eyes, but we sent our staff person, there, who was there for 10 days. And he said that the government was much more organized than we were at Katrina, having been in both places. So in a funny way, that connects, that the government was really quite there. So I do think that there are structures in the government. The Musharraf has, and the army have managed to do that. The question is, what are they doing about terrorism?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
finally, you said Katrina. We have about a half a minute left.
Well, Katrina, I mean, there was, you know, the president talking, using the experience of today to also talk about how charter schools are working there. Hello, they just haven't put the money into education there. So they haven't had many options except charter schools.
Well, this is what they do. They break public schools, and then they say, oh, look, private schools are wonderful. They break our health care system, and they say, oh, look, private health care is wonderful. They break the VA system, and they say, oh, look, we should probably privatize the VA. They break Social Security, and they say, oh, maybe we should privatize Social Security. It's once
more,
right?
And maybe we broke Iraq, and maybe we should privatize that whole country.
Well, that was the original idea.
Exactly.
that's how Bremer went in and changed the Constitution. It didn't work out quite like they planned.
I had to add that.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. It was the perfect punctuation for the segment. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Ellen, always wonderful to have you on. Thanks so much
for
being
with us. Thank
you. Good talking to you. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
We will, I promise you, we will be consistent. continuing our conversation about what's going on with Iran and the state of the world. But occasionally, it's useful to check in on some of the other topics of life. You know, there's sometimes you think you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't know what you do know. Sometimes even everything, as the Fireside Theater says, you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is everything you know is wrong about normal wrong? Jonathan Mooney is with us. He's the author of a new book called The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. Jonathan Mooney, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Well, thank you. You visited more than a dozen people who had been diagnosed with a whole variety of things that all had the word disability attached to them, from attention deficit disorder to dyslexia to autism to Down syndrome. And you tell some fascinating stories in this book. First of all, the big picture, the frame. You want to just riff on that for a second?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, the story starts with myself. Got to be honest with you, Tom. I'm dyslexic. I'm ADD. I was diagnosed in fourth grade, dropped out of school for a year in sixth grade, was told that I'd flip burgers from a high school guidance counselor, was told that I would end up in jail by the same guidance counselor. I shocked those skeptics by graduating from Brown University with an honors degree in English literature, by becoming an activist in the field of learning diversity. So first and foremost, the book is that story. You know, it's that journey from a kid who had a plan for suicide at 12 years old to a young man that celebrated his differences. Beyond mm-hmm. that, the book is a cross-country journey. It's 35,000 miles, 4 months in a converted short school bus, the kind that takes kids to special education, where I explore the myth of normalcy by telling other people's stories.
Yeah, for example, Mooney in Austin, Texas. Kent in Austin. You're Mooney. Jonathan Mooney.
Thanks for reminding me. I forget sometimes.
Yeah, there you go. I'm sorry. Kent, who you met in Austin, Texas.
Beautiful story, you know, and in many respects inspired by some of your work on ADD, to be honest with you. Kent Roberts is a young man labeled ADD. He went to Brown University with me, and his story and his experience is really an insight into the paradox of ADD, that sometimes our greatest strengths come hand in hand with our greatest weaknesses. On one hand, Kent Roberts almost failed out of Brown University. He has the attention span of a gnat, literally, you know, couldn't turn his homework in, et cetera, but on the other hand, Kent Roberts performed 24 hours of straight stand-up comedy while at Brown University. Where's the deficit of attention in that act, you know? Kent Roberts is an individual who celebrates that paradox about himself. Very inspiring individual for me.
Yeah, it's a great story. And down in the deep south, there's Butch.
Butch Anthony, dyslexic, didn't learn to read until he was in his teenage years, was told that he was stupid, was actually labeled mentally retarded for a time. But yet Butch, who's an artist, who is a self-taught architect, has such a highly developed visual sense that he found the first dinosaur bone ever in the state of Alabama. A guy who couldn't read, literally couldn't write, went on a full ride paleontology scholarship to Auburn. You know, these are the type of stories that force us to question the idea of a normal cognition or normal neurological structure. They're the type of stories that force us to question this idea that somehow people with dyslexia have a problem or people with ADD have a deficit or a disorder. And they're the type of stories that force us to understand the reality of cognitive diversity.
Yeah, and perhaps most importantly, at least, you know, for a political talk show, force us to examine the question of whether or not we should be creating social institutions like our public education system that really is designed to teach in only one way, to only one type of intelligence, to only one type of learning style, and that labels everybody who doesn't fit into that neat little assembly line as somehow broken.
As less than, you know, as defective.
Yeah.
And not only challenge the structure of public institutions, but understand the political power dynamics that are underneath that. You know, the type of intelligence that we've defined as the normal intelligence, logical linguistic intelligence, happens to be one narrow way to be smart. It happens to be the way that one group of people in power define intelligence. And it marginalizes minorities. It marginalizes people of low income. You know, I'll tell you, some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life, you know, they don't read well, but they can rebuild that car engine from scratch, right?
Yeah,
some of the stupidest people I've ever met in my life have had PhDs, you know? But yet in school, if you don't fit that definition of intelligence, you get that message that you're less than. You get that message that somehow you're broken. And so many young people believe that. You know, so many young people buy into that, and I think it's a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah, and a remarkable piece of work you've done here, Jonathan. Jonathan Mooney, the website, jonathanmooney.com, the book, The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. And, Jonathan, thanks for sharing with us.
Thanks so much for having me on your program, Tom.
Thanks for coming on. 11 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Speaking of education, Rebecca in Edmond, Washington, you're educating folks with YouTube?
Yes. I'm sorry, what did you just say, Tom?
I said welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
I didn't, but welcome.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, I called in originally soon after 9 to talk about a really positive way of getting our message out, and then all this news came on and about the war in Iran, and actually I wanted to say that we heard Representative McDermott at a fundraiser, which we had for him, say, if you think Iraq is bad, just wait until September. He said, I greatly fear and have reason to believe that we will be in Iran. So that's very heavy, but what I called on a lighter note, if I could kind of segue to that, one really fun way a way that's really fun to get our message out is what we did, what some people did on Monday when Dave Reichert and Bush came to Bellevue, Washington.
Right.
Some people, this is just brilliant and really cute, some women, young women who are, you know, attractive, or they don't have to be young women, but anyway, they dressed up like beauty queens,
mm-hmm.
and they started something called the I Miss America pageant.
Oh, isn't that sweet? Like, as in, I miss what America used to be.
Right. And so then we had people interviewing him and say, well, what do you miss about America? And they would say, well, I miss my civil liberties, or I miss our free press, or I miss our regulations on corporations. And then they would talk about their issue. And so young women all over this country can get actively involved in political events, small and large, by just doing this. It's really fun. And they can really get into some very serious issues this way.
That's
so anyway,
great.
That we had Washington for Impeachment and many other organizations got together to plan this for this event. We had, I think, over 1,000 people, the people who were there. And I wanted
now,
to
is it true, Rebecca, I read a news report mm-hmm. that when George Bush's motorcade drove by mm-hmm. many of you who were protesting his presence there at the fundraiser for Dave Reichert, that automatic weapons were pointed out of the windows of some of the cars at the protesters?
You know, I don't know about that. I was not able to actually be there in person, although I worked on the planning for it. But, mm-hmm. you know, Todd Boyle, excuse me, Todd Boyle of Kirkland does a lot of videography,
yeah.
and he puts it up on YouTube. And if people will just Google for his name, T-O-D-D,
yeah.
Todd Boyle.
I'll have to go looking for it.
Yeah.
I'll have to go check it out. Rebecca, thank you very much for the heads up on all this. It's much appreciated. And I've had several emails from people who were there, who purport to have been there, who saw that, and it's chilling. Of course, it wouldn't be the first time that it has happened. Darwin in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening to WTKG. Hey, Darwin, what's up?
Hi.
You are on the air.
Oh,
I know you've been waiting quite a while, Darwin. I thank you for sticking around. What's up?
First off, I'd like to thank you for your radio program.
You're welcome, but it's not necessary. It's just get right into your topic.
Okay. Well, I've become outraged with what our Congress is doing, and I'm not seeing the outrage anywhere else. A few years ago, our Congress thought it was correct to spend $52 million to find out that the president at that time, Bill Clinton, had a penis. And now, with over 3,000 American citizens dead in the war in Iraq, they haven't spent one dime to see if it was done legally, correctly, and morally. Where's the outrage from the people?
The outrage is broad and deep, Darwin. The outrage is all over America. I'm telling you, just because you don't see people burning down cities doesn't mean that people are not outraged in this country. They
not
are.
Burning.
And members of Congress who are showing up for their community visits this summer, they're absolutely getting hell. Absolutely getting hell. So people are showing up, Darwin. I share your concern, and I you know, it's like at times you feel like, oh, we've got to do a little bit more. Okay, well, you know, we'll get there. We'll get there. We really will. 16 minutes past this.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
The Crush. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Anna Berger on the line with us with the SEIU. She is the chair of Change to Win and the international secretary treasurer of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU.org, their website. Hey, Anna, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Labor Day is coming up. In fact, I'm going to take the day off. It's which is something I very rarely do, but being a proud dues-paying member of two different unions, I figured, okay, my unions have been fighting for, or the union movement has been fighting for the right to a day off from time to time for the better part of 100 years. I'm going to do it. And you're suggesting that there's a labor resurgence happening in the United States. And I find that, you know, broadly to be very good news. Is it true?
I think it is true. I think that working people in America have woken up to realize that they are falling further and further behind. They're working more hours, more jobs for less money than at any time in the last 25 years, and they want to have their voice, and they want to share in the prosperity of our country. And whenever, you know, poll after poll shows that if workers had an opportunity free of coercion to have a union, they would choose a union overwhelmingly.
Yeah, the vast majority. And yet the Employee Free Choice Act, the ability, you know, card check, the ability of workers to form a union in a relatively easy and straightforward fashion, simple and highly democratic fashion, was blocked by the Republicans in the United States Senate and blocked by George W. Bush. And there wasn't the broad, frankly, there were the broad, wide public outcry that I expected there would be.
Well, I think that it is a remarkable time, though, that the overwhelming majority of the U.S. Congress voted in support of workers having a free voice in the job and supported the Employee Free Choice Act, and the majority in the Senate did. Now, we understand that we're going to have to do this all over again when we have the next Congress and a new president, and we think that we have to be on the ground talking door-to-door with people, with voters, about the importance of the Employee Free Choice Act so that there is a groundswell of support. And that the next president understands that they have to sign this bill into law when it hits their desk, and that the leadership in the Senate and the House understand that they have to get it to the president's desk so that we can actually have an opportunity for workers to have a voice in the job and share in the prosperity of our country. It's not as if our country isn't prospering. The problem is that the people who work hard every day are the ones who are being fallen further and further behind. We can change that.
And at a certain level, it even goes beyond that, because when workers organize, it's not just in the workplace. I mean, obviously, people are organizing in the workplace, but it revitalizes democracy. It invigorates democracy. Unions have been at the front of a whole variety of social change movements, from civil rights movements to, in some cases, the anti-war movement, to, in some cases, women's rights movements. I mean, unions have been agents of social change in the United States, as much outside the workplace or outside the realm of employment, let's say, as they have been within the workplace.
Right. And the reality is unions have raised up not only whole families and whole industries, but whole communities and whole generations. It is, in fact, what enabled each generation to give a better life to their children than they had had. And right now, our country is at risk of having a generation that gives the next generation a worse life because of this shrinking power of the labor movement.
Yeah. I spoke at one of the large national unions. I keynoted one of the large national unions conferences 3 years ago, 4 years ago. It was the year that Change to Win and AFL-CIO split off. How long ago was that?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. Okay. So much for my sense
of time. Our 2 year convention is just coming up later this month.
Yeah. Okay. Then it was the year that was happening, And there was a lot of concern. This was not the SEIU conference that I was speaking at. And there was a lot of, although I did here in Portland, I spoke at the SEIU conference last year, but there was a lot of concern about what was going to happen with this schism. And frankly, my sense of it was that, you know, the AFL and the CIO joining kind of slowed down labor way back in the day, and that having a couple of major labor voices out there would revitalize the labor movement. Is that how it's worked out?
I believe so. The reality is, in my life, and I'm 56 years old, the labor movement has gotten smaller and smaller, not more powerful each day of my life, and that we needed to turn things around. Change the Wing came together because our unions believed that we needed to organize and grow, and that we needed to organize workers now and in the growing part of the economy where they had been unorganized. And across our Change the Wind Federation, all of our unions are putting more resources into organizing than ever before. They have more organizers on the ground. They have more researchers on corporations. And we are using our power for each other to help each other organize workers in a way that we've never done before. So I think
And on the other side, the AFL-CIO is getting active. It has been, I think, frankly, energized as well.
I think so. I think that, you know, competition can be good.
Yeah,
and I think and our ability to still work together around areas that we have common strategies and common interests continues. We work politically together, and I think that we have been more effective as a result of it.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's been really nice to watch is in particular with things, for example, card check, the employee, the right to unionize. Anna Berger, SEIU.org, the website. She's the chair of Change to Win, the International Secretary Treasurer of the Service Employees International Union. Y'all are doing just great work. Anna, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Take care.
Good speaking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Samson in Hercules, California. Samson in Hercules?
Yeah, there's a little town just east of San Francisco called Hercules.
And a guy named Samson.
I wanted to make a comment on two issues: how we got to the state of the war on terror, and then what's going on right now in Iran. The first responders, 500 of them, were turned away from the King Commission when they wanted to testify about bombs in the building. 20 were allowed to testify, and they did. Their testimony was the only testimony taken behind closed doors and was the only testimony sealed by Bush to cover up his crime of 9/11. So there needs to be a complete investigation because as Keene and the Hamilton were controlled, the Keene's Helico Commission was controlled by Zellico right out of the White House, controlled demolition and U.S. Air Force training exercises were never factors to be examined. Now, that said, Iran has apparently been given Sunburn cruise missiles, 1,300-mile-an-hour missiles with 6 times Hiroshima nuclear bomb package on board. Russia is building nuclear plants in there, and so is China developing the petrochemical field. So if Israel or the United States attacks Iran, the adage is use them or lose them. So it could very quickly and very easily turn into a nuclear confrontation. And then what are China and Russia supposed to do?
Right.
So,
and it's unlikely, frankly, that Russia will attack the United States with nukes because we would retaliate and it would be back to mutually assured destruction. But possible, in my opinion, is that we could see a combined effort to shut down oil in the world on the part of Russia, and they control an awful lot of oil, and to shut down the world economy on the part of China, and this would bring the United States to its knees.
Well, that's very true. However, oil, gasoline will cost us, 30% of it comes through the Straits of Hormuz, will cost us probably $10 a gallon. Now, if they do launch nukes to defend themselves, it'd be within their own rights. That could mean that three or four of our aircraft carriers would disappear. Now, Eisenhower, his policy was if nukes are exchanged in theater, that is one thing, and it would be contained. It wouldn't become intercontinental. But in this situation in Russia and China's backyard, anything is up for grabs. Now, Russia has started strategic nuclear bombing runs like they did during the Cold War. They have these aircraft in the air with missiles with 2,000-mile ranges. They believe, why would they do it without those missiles flying around
now,
the world?
Putin has been pretty upfront about, you know, why he's doing this. He's very angry that we're citing this whole Star Wars program in Czechoslovakia and Poland. And,
well,
you know, right in his backyard, that we're cutting these deals with his former allies, and to put missiles and other things in there that have a throw range right into Moscow.
Well, Russia has reined in its budget. It has paid. It's going to apply for a gold-backed ruble. It's paid off its debt. It's brought things around very well fiscally, and now they're being confronted with an aggressive United States that has agreed not to put forward military bases in Asia after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But after 9/11, they went forward and did that. So I just think that people really need to. They're the critical mass. We are the critical mass. We don't need a majority. We need to be radioactive in the sense that we need to get out there and shut this down. The Joint Chiefs at least twice have said no to this, and we need to be their constituency and advocate
Absolutely. And the point that I started to make earlier was that Richard Nixon was actually intending to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. He had everything in place to do it. He was intending to order a nuclear strike against Hanoi. And there was this huge, and this is an example of mass demonstration, but again, I would say that was the symptom, not the cause. The cause was that there were millions of people all across the United States, but there was this huge mass demonstration in Washington, D.C., and Nixon saw that, and he just really, you know, I think he looked out the window and he said, holy cow, these people are going to show up with torches and pitchforks if I do this. I mean, it's just, there was that point. And you go back and you look now at the biographies and the Nixon tapes, and Nixon backed down. He decided not to attack Vietnam with nuclear weapons simply because of all the protests, simply because we the people spoke. Suzanne in Studio City, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Suzanne. Suzanne, you are on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've been waiting too long. Okay, this brings me right to the point. What I did yesterday and how I found out about it, I was on the corner of our metro station in North Hollywood with about 30 or 40 people. It was a local protest. However, there were thousands of them scheduled all over the state and nationally, probably millions in different locations. I found out about it because I have Barbara Boxer emails me, and I also have a local network here. They're out on the corner every week on Friday evening on the corner of Laurel Canyon and Ventura Boulevard, and they email me every week about the local protests. And I wanted to let the listeners know that this is already happening. What you're talking about with Dennis is already happening, and that they should get in touch with any local or national legislators who are sympathetic, who could email them the information, or any local organization, or the MoveOn.org would email them all the information about these protests. And I also wanted to say that I didn't have the internet for over a year, and I went to my local library once or twice a week and kept my email going, which is care2.com, which is an environmentally friendly website where you can have free email, and mm-hmm. Yahoo and Hotmail have free email. So sure. You have no excuse not to get in touch and stay in touch and find out about all these protests that are happening all over the
certainly.
Country.
Absolutely, and I think it's marvelous that Barbara Boxer's office is sending that out. I didn't realize that she was doing that, and I salute her. Barbara Boxer is one of the best members of the Senate. She's absolutely one of my heroes.
Too. I don't know. There's other legislators that are also sympathetic and would get in. Anyway,
that's absolutely
what I wanted
marvelous. To say. Thank you, Suzanne. I appreciate the call. And the one thing not to use email for is to contact your members of Congress. And the reason why is because they're all getting so spammed and slammed, and they know that, you know, people can do the equivalent of robocalls with email. And so many of them now have gone to a form you can fill out on their website where it filters so that they know, you know, who you are because you put in your address and your zip code, and they know if you're a constituent. In that case, they will pay attention to what you have to say. But generally, the easiest way, the best way to contact members of Congress is to simply to give them a call. And, you know, just call them up. The telephone number for Congress is 202-225-3121. That gets you to Capitol Hill. Regardless of where you live, you have one Congress, one member of Congress, one member of the House of Representatives, rather, and two members of the United States Senate, and unless you live in Washington, D.C. And even there, you have a representative. And it's 202-225-3121. Carol in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Carol.
Hello.
Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi. It's very interesting that you connected to me right now. What I was going to start with is, to borrow a phrase from Larry Craig. Oh. Hi.
Yeah, you're on. Oh, you've got to listen to your phone, not the radio, Carol.
Yes, I am. I'm sorry. I kind of zoned out.
You were talking about
naughty boy.
I know
bad
that.
Bad boy, a naughty boy. A nasty, bad, naughty boy.
You wanted to talk about Larry Craig?
No, I wanted to borrow a phrase from him, which was, diggity God.
Yeah.
The more I listen, the more comments I have. But what I wanted to talk about is what the last woman talked about and what Dennis and people like that said, which was that you've had a number of callers from Michigan, but they seem perfectly unaware of the fact that there were protests here, or no, there were peace demonstrations here in Michigan last night. One of them attended by my representative, John Conyers. The main reason for my call is I need some advice. Part of it you just gave is to call as opposed to writing. I'm a constituent. How do I push impeachment?
Well, with regard to Congressman Conyers or any other member of Congress, frankly, you can call the Washington, D.C. office. That's the quick and easy thing to do. The other thing that you can do is check out their website and get their local phone number. I'm sure Congressman Conyers probably has two or three local offices in his district.
And I believe contact he does.
Yeah, and you contact the local districts, the local district offices. And, in fact, if you can drop by and say hi, that's a good thing. One of the things that Bernie Sanders suggested, 4 years ago, I think, on this program, and he's talked about it a number of times, is he said this is one of the things that's almost impossible for a member of Congress to resist, particularly the House of Representatives. It's a little easier for a senator to ignore, but with a member of Congress, if you can get 50 to 100 people together, and you can rent, typically you don't even have to rent them. You get a library or you get a school gymnasium or, a church that'll let you use the church or whatever. The Unitarian churches are very good at this. And you put together a town hall for that member of Congress. And keep in mind that, they're typically home over the weekend. Saturday is generally a good day because they fly home on Fridays and they go back sometimes on Sundays or Mondays. And then contact their office and say, hey, there's 100 of us here, and we'd love to have you come talk with us. And we'll publicize it, and we'll get it out in the paper, and we're going to do all this kind of stuff. And at that point, they pretty much have no choice. And that was Bernie's advice. He said, if you really want to back a member of the House of Representatives into a corner, that's how you do it. Or not necessarily back them into a corner. Lobby them. If you want to lobby them as citizen lobbyists, that's how you do it. So, Carol, there's another idea. Physical letters, if you're going to write a physical letter, don't send it to the Washington, D.C. office because then it goes through a four-month-long process to check for anthrax. Instead, send it to the local offices. The local offices will actually get your physical letters. Those are important. Write letters to the editor of the newspaper. Call, talk radio, right-wing, left-wing, everything in between. Let people know what you're thinking.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Before the hour, Sharon in Seattle, Washington, listening on KPTK. Hey, Sharon, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for everything you do. I'm wondering if Bush is using the threat of going to war with Iran to scare the Dems into passing his Iraq war funding bill, and then he can always go to war later anyway.
That's a good question. It would make sense that they would do that, use that as a strategy. He's and apropos of that, you know, as I'm sure you know, he's now it's coming out that they're going to be asking for another $50 billion. And this is another opportunity for Congress to say, no, we're going to end the war right now because we're not going to fund it any longer. And, of course, it's going to be another one of these do you support the troops or not kind of things. And, Sharon, thank you. That's an interesting point, very interesting point. Jesse in San Diego, California. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Tom. First of all, you know, Nixon was going to nuke Hanoi, and then he cut a deal with China. So, I mean, we can still deal with Iran. But the more I analyze this whole thing from 9/11 on, it looks to me like it's been a squeeze play all the way on the Shiites, because you don't get much closer to the royal family than Osama bin Laden's family. You know that?
Yeah.
And but
there's no doubt about that. But so, but what's your point?
But what it is, if it's been a squeeze play all the way to get to tap Iran, and they made the miscalculation in Iraq. The thing is that Iran, they'll pick their place where they want to fight the war.
Who's the they you're talking about?
The Iranians will. If we cap Iran, they'll pick where they want to fight.
Absolutely. But there's not that many Shiite countries. Keep in mind, Shia Islam is the minority. You know, Sunni Islam is the vast majority. You know, from Saudi Arabia to Indonesia, it's almost all Sunni. And you've got a few Shia countries. A few, you know, where there's Shia majorities in Iran, Iraq, and Syria, for example. But, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Yemen, Kuwait, Qatar, all of these countries, and all the way down into Southern Asia, as I recall, they're all Sunni, or largely Sunni.
But what you just said sort of confirms that this was a setup all the way from 9/11 on to get to Iran, because it would work for the Sunnis, and they've been sort of, you know, behind the scenes the whole time.
So you're suggesting that everything from 9/11 to this point has been orchestrated by the Saudi royal family in order to bring down Iran. Why would the Saudi royal family want to bring down Iran?
Not orchestrated by them, in conjunction with Halliburton and company, if you get my drift. But
sure.
Because they're running out of oil, and Iran's sitting on most of the oil, and there's a large number of Shia in Iraq, but the Bush administration doesn't have the mental capacity to pull this whole deal off. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you start getting into the geopolitical chessboard here, and it gets really, really complex. But, Jesse, interesting point. And it's also interesting to note, I think, that the majority of the folks in the oil fields of Saudi Arabia, while Saudi is principally a Sunni country and it's governed by Sunnis, the majority of the people, the average person who lives in the areas where they pump the oil in Saudi Arabia, are Shiites. And it's a real political problem for the Saudi royal family. They've been stepping on these guys with an iron fist or foot or heel or whatever for a long time. Judy in Mahwah, New Jersey. Hey, Judy.
Hey. My question is, what can the Congress stop him from Bush from dropping bombs on Iran? Is there any way to prevent it? I mean, it would seem to be declaring a war, a de facto war, but because he scares me, and I think it's really possible. And, you know, I was in the vigils yesterday, and I call my congressman regularly, and he's a Republican and not interested in life of the born, only of the unborn. And I keep reminding him. But is there anything they can do to stop him?
Yes. Yeah. And it's been done before. They could pass a resolution specifically forbidding the president from attacking Iran. I mean, they could do it.
So that's what we have to call and ask them to do.
Yeah. I don't, I wouldn't, well, who knows? Yeah. Yes. That would be a good call to action. I'm thinking out loud here. I don't know how effective it would be. I'm not sure who the point person would be to lead the thing. I mean, there are some obvious, you know, folks who are very strong in the peace movement, you know, like Dennis Kucinich. But as these guys, and we've seen this twice now, well, we've seen it three times, really, if you go back, as these guys start ginning up a war, and Judy, thank you for the call, as they start ginning up a war, they start getting very persuasive. I mean, and their language can get very, very scary.
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups. The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons. Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
And I'm just, you know, it's deja vu all over again. I mean, it's Bush. I mean, this is how he was talking about Iraq, right? It's...
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
And now we're hearing the same kind of rhetoric about Iran. Very, very, very challenging times. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking with Rick Scarborough, the right-wing campaign, 70 weeks to save America. Save America? We'd like to save America, too. Chris Hayes is here claiming he has the truth behind the NAFTA superhighway. Christy Harvey with News Under the Radar, plus the best of the rest of the news, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. 57 minutes past, well, it's the end of the hour. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.